You're listening to the Hog Sports Network Daily Podcast. Now, here's your host, Matt Jones.
A happy Tuesday to you, everybody, except Hugh Freeze. We've got a fun podcast on tap today. Kelly Rolliard, former Razorback soccer player, who's the soccer analyst for SEC Network games here in Fayetteville. She'll be on set to talk about the number one ranked Arkansas soccer team. Also, we'll have Carlos Collazo, an MLB draft reporter for Baseball America, a little bit later. They've got a new top 100 list out. It's got three Razorbacks on it. We'll talk to him about that. Also talking to him about Hagan Smith and Hagan, what he expects for him as he moves through the White Sox organization. But first, it's what everybody's talking about today, and it's Hugh Freeze sticking his foot in his mouth last night at his weekly radio show, and we'll have that played for you here in just a second. Go ahead and just play that, Blake.
Of the game, and yeah, we and it's the truth for me too. I'm not, because we've got to get them to where the winning ways are happening on those critical downs. I mean, no offense whatsoever to Arkansas or to Cal. I love Sam Pittman. I hope he wins the rest of his games. But I'm telling you, the hard truth is we play them nine more times, we beat them nine times. And that's what's hard to take. And it's hard for our fans, I'm sure, and it's certainly hard for us. And you have 460-something yards, and we only had 50-something plays of offense because we turned it over five times. And it's just it's frustrating.
So that's Hugh Freeze. Did you hear the baby crying in the background?
That was like
the cherry on top of that soundbite.
Yeah.
The arrogance of this guy. I mean, what game did he watch?
Well, anytime anybody starts a sentence off by saying, now, no offense to somebody, you know, whoever. Yep. Take offense to it, because it's going to be offensive.
Yep, that's right. I mean, the only thing I think Hugh Freeze wins 9 out of 9 times is an ego contest. I think he's undefeated when it comes to the ego. He has got one of the biggest egos in college football coaching, and that is saying something in his profession. I think Deion Sanders hears something like that. He says, whoa, man, you know, you might want to take a step back.
Yeah.
I don't know what game he was watching, because when I look at Arkansas-Auburn, there was no point in that game, Chip, where I felt like Auburn was outplaying Arkansas
Never.
At any point in the game.
Never.
Every time that Auburn scored, Arkansas had an answer. That's winning football.
Oh, that was only two times, by the way.
That was two times. But time of possession, Arkansas
dominated.
Owned them.
Yeah.
Critical downs, third and fourth down. Arkansas was like 11 for 23. Auburn was 6 for 14. Auburn couldn't get Arkansas off the field.
Get them off the field.
The Razorbacks, points off turnovers, 10 to nothing. Turnovers, 5 to 2. They win the turnover battle. And you go on and on and on. Total plays, like 83 to 61. The only place where Auburn outplayed Arkansas statistically was in yards, like 431 to 334. But I think about 70 of those yards came at the end when Arkansas falls into kind of a soft prevent defense, because they're going to sacrifice yards for seconds off the clock when they're up by 10 points. And then – we saw at Oklahoma State a couple of weeks ago, yards are a dime a dozen. It's all of it matters
last
what
checked,
you
Matt,
do.
And last I checked, it matters on who has more points on one side than the other. That's what matters.
But yards, it matters what you do with them.
Yeah,
if you're going by yards, Arkansas beats Oklahoma State 9 out of 10 times.
Yeah.
But we didn't hear Sam Pittman making that kind of statement. You know, he said, we got to go get better. We've got to, you know, we got to do this better. We got to convert in the red zone. And that's what I didn't hear from Freeze right there. And I feel like what Freeze did was totally discredits Arkansas's effort that they gave on Saturday. I heard Chuck Barrett talking about this morning. He said, I still believe in sportsmanship. I believe in going across and shaking the hand of your competitor and telling him good game. And that is total antithesis of that, what you hear from Hugh Freeze. And we hear all these stories about Freeze, how he's not a good guy. He's not a good person to play for, this and that and that. And, you know, sometimes you think, well, you know, maybe that guy's just jaded or they had a bad experience. But when he says something like this, it really, I think, gives credence to all of the bad things that you've heard about him. I can't remember in 20 years of covering college sports, maybe it's happened, but I can't remember another coach making a comment like this. You might hear him say something like, hey, if we played him 10 more times, maybe we win 5 of those.
Yeah.
Okay, I'd give you some, you know, I might believe that. But to say you're going to win 9 out of 9,
well, it's
times,
just pure disrespect, is what it is. It's
have you seen his record?
It's about 8-9 or something.
8-9.
Yeah.
So he wins games at like a 45-47% clip, and he says he's going to beat a team 100% of the time. I don't buy that at all.
Well, Hugh Freeze is what I call a yabbit coach. He's a yabbit.
A what?
A yabbit.
He's a yabbit.
He's a yabbit. He's we gained. You know, we had 400 yards total offense. Yeah, but we did this.
Okay.
We did this, but yeah, but we did that. So I call those guys yabbits, and those guys they never own anything. They never own mistakes. They never own that some team was better. They never own anything. And that's what Freeze is. He's a yabbit.
Where do you come up with this?
It's just, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, it's yeah, they did this, but, yeah, but, yeah, but, yeah, but. There's always the but in there.
Hey, Chip, can you spell that for everyone real quick?
Y-A-B-U-T-T.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. See, you learned something today. A yabbit.
I've learned something.
He's a yabbit.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
I don't know that I've ever had as, like, visceral a reaction to hearing a coach say something like that than I had to Hugh Freeze saying this. I mean, it just –
well, just
– I feel bad for – I feel bad for his team.
You would like to think a guy who's leading an SEC program would be – you know, would have ownership when their team plays bad, or would be at least mature enough to accept – the responsibility that our team got dominated Saturday. They got dominated.
Mm.
Own it. It happened. Everybody saw it.
And it's not the first time that it's happened to them this year. And I think that's the thing, is that they've got a real quarterback problem. So you're going to tell me that with the two quarterbacks that you just threw under the bus and put it in reverse on Saturday after the game,
again and again,
that those
and again,
two
yeah.
quarterbacks, Hank Brown and Peyton Thorne, are going to – go out and somehow miraculously figure out how to quit throwing the ball to the other team and beat them 9 out of 9 times?
Yeah,
I don't buy that.
I mean, not the way they looked, you know, not the way they looked Saturday.
And none of this is to say that Arkansas is like this head and shoulders better team than Auburn, because I don't think they are.
But on that day,
but on
they
that
were.
Day when they played, yes. they were. I think every coach could make a comment like this that says, hey, you know, if we played them again, you know, we win more times than we lose. But that's not how the game works. That's not how we – Arkansas was a, what, 5-6-point favorite to beat Auburn last year in Fayetteville? And that game's 48-3 at the end of the third quarter.
Right.
And if Hugh Freeze wants to, he can score 70 on Arkansas in that game.
And he said as much.
He could have.
Yeah.
But, you know, we don't go back and say, well, you know, hey, if you would have played Arkansas 9 more times, this would have been the record. We just own it. Hey, you were the better team that day. It was a horrible loss for Arkansas, really, you know, set in motion a course of events at the end of the year that made it an uncomfortable November for the Razorbacks. But that's not how the game works. And it just, I don't know, it bothers me when a coach doesn't own his own mistakes and his own inefficiencies and his own problems and tries to spin it away like this. It's,
here's one for you, Matt. Even Eli Drinkwitz wouldn't say this. I mean,
Eli Drinkwitz sent Freeze a text this morning. Hey, man, you might want to back off on being a bully.
Exactly. Exactly. If Eli Drinkwitz won't cross that line, you shouldn't cross that line.
No. No. Yeah, Drinkwitz wants to be the new age Steve Spurrier.
Yeah.
Let's talk about a few other things for Razorback football. Rashad DeBinion is not going to play at least this week. He's suspended indefinitely by Sam Pittman. I got a few thoughts on this. Number one, this is not why he hasn't played to this point in the season. We had a reporter, I think it was Christina, who asked this after the press conference yesterday, you know, is this why he hasn't played or is this something new? And she was told, no, this is something new. So that's number one. Remember, he had an injury in the preseason that I think affected his playing time, at least early in the year. Jaquindon Jackson playing the way he is, I think, affects this too. Not to mention, I think they might have other running backs who are, you know, that they're playing at a fairly decent level. But number two is that just because it's an indefinite suspension doesn't mean it's like this long-term time that he's going to be out. We don't know what's going on with Rashad DeBinion. So I would be hesitant, Chip, to write him off for the rest of the year. You know, we don't know how he's going to react to this. We don't know what's going on behind the scenes, like we said. But I think a lot of times people hear an indefinite and they say, okay, well, that's pretty much forever.
Indefinite means 10 minutes or 10 games.
Right.
We don't know what indefinite means.
We'll see what happens there. If you would have said 3 weeks ago that DeBinion was going to be out indefinitely, I think there would have maybe been some concern. But I like what I've seen from Braylon Russell.
Well, why wouldn't you? Yeah, I mean,
and I think Hill is a serviceable enough running back.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think they've got some weapons there, obviously, and then Jaquindon Jackson. And even though Taylen Green's not a running back, he might as well be because he's one of the best ball carriers in the SEC.
Well, Matt, you go back to the spring game, the red-white game. DeBinion didn't play that much in that game, and he didn't play – you know, he wasn't running – that much with the ones or whatever in the practices leading up to that game. And it, I got a sense back then he had been passed. I mean, he had just been passed on the depth chart. You know, that's no disgrace. It happens. They, you know, I had a coach tell me one time, my job is to find players better than you. Your job is to not allow me to find those players. You don't be better than what I bring in. That's the way coaching, that's the way sports works. I'm looking to find players better than you. Your job is to make sure no one is better than you.
Pittman said the Dabinion suspension is for a violation of team rules. Who knows what that's for? A few personnel notes. Hudson Clark potentially could be back this weekend in Arlington. Jalen Braxton could potentially be back for the game against A&M this weekend. T.J. Metcalf, who kind of made everybody forget that Arkansas had injuries in the secondary last week with how he played against Auburn. He got SEC Defensive Player of the Week on Monday.
Deserved.
And to me, I mean, that, and I said this yesterday, that felt like an All-America type performance.
Well, no doubt.
It felt like what we've seen in the past from, you know, and it's typically Kirby Smart safeties, whether he was coaching them as a position coach or a coordinator at Alabama or now a head coach at Georgia. It just feels like the type of game that you would expect out of those types of safeties where they are all over the field. He's tipping the ball that a guy picks. He's intercepting it a couple of times. He's forcing a fumble. He's making a big tackle. That was as impressive of a game that I can remember by an Arkansas safety in quite some time. The Razorbacks, I don't know where they found this, but they had a stat the other day that said he was the first Arkansas safety with two interceptions and at least one forced fumble and one pass breakup or two pass breakups since Kenoy Kennedy in 1999. I mean, Kenoy Kennedy,
he was
that's right there with Steve Atwater, I feel like, as the greats at that position at Arkansas.
Well, he definitely impacted the game, you know, had a career game. I mean, that's a career game.
The question now is, can he continue to play like that?
Sure. Because
I'm sure there was a lot of motivation to have a big game. He's from Alabama, the Birmingham area. Yeah. He's a couple of hours from home, had a big group of people that were there watching him. Now can he do what he did against Auburn and take it into another game? I think he could potentially do it. You look at right now, he's got the SEC, or he's tied for the SEC lead in interceptions. He had one that closed out the Birmingham game the week before. But they need that type of dominance from somebody on defense. We thought that we were going to get it from Landon Jackson, and for whatever reason, he just hasn't shown up as a real dominant player yet this year. Maybe he does as the season goes along. But Metcalf, that is a dominant-type performance that if they can replicate that or even come close to it, that helps you in a big way moving down the road.
He's got those great bloodlines, too. I mean, DJ Metcalf, they're related. Got, you know, great receiver for the Seahawks. I mean, he's got good bloodlines, and it's good to see a player like that, you know, step up, especially with injuries to other players. And, you know, that's what you want is those guys that are underneath, when they get their opportunity, make the most of it. And that's what he's doing.
Our buddy Olin Buchanan from TexAgs.com is going to be on the podcast tomorrow. We'll talk to him about Texas A&M and, you know, kind of how he sees this matchup. But I'll give you my view on it here real quick. I feel like these two teams are kind of mirror images.
They
right kind of
are, and their quarterbacks are kind of similar.
Very
Marcel
similar.
Reed, he's a redshirt freshman.
That's if they stick with Reed.
Well, if they do.
Wickman's been injured, so if he's available this week, who knows how that affects that. But they've won with Reed the last 2 weeks, and with Wickman, it was kind of felt like, you know, they were stuck in the mud a little bit.
Right, and Reed's a dual threat. I mean, he's as effective with his way more effective with his legs than he is with his arms, kind of like Taylen Green. He's a better runner probably than passer, but he did have a nice game against Bowling Green, a game they had kind of struggled to win. But
well, and that's what I was gonna say is, you know, you look at their schedule to this point, they're both 3-1. They both lost the game, the big non-conference game on their schedule, a game that they probably feel like they could have or should have won. Arkansas
definitely
lost
winnable
to Oklahoma State. Texas A&M had Notre Dame tied
they
late
did
in the fourth quarter.
Yeah.
And then even like, you know, their last non-SEC game, Arkansas is a 22.5-point favorite to beat UAB. We saw how that game went. A&M was a 22.5-point favorite to beat Bowling Green the other night down at Kyle Field.
Yeah.
Very similar, like a 6-point game because Bowling Green kicks a field goal late, can't recover the onside kick. So I just feel like these two teams, and I feel like this more often than not when they get together in Arlington, they just feel like they are very evenly matched.
Yeah.
Even if the talent doesn't necessarily scream that. I mean, A&M obviously recruits at a better level than Arkansas does, but I feel like they're typically very evenly matched. And I feel like that's why the series has gone the way it has down at AT&T Stadium.
You know, last year's game, even though Arkansas, it was obvious they were not playing well and they had problems in the offensive line, they had a really great start to that game. You know, that they the opening drive, they're driving down the field, they hit Luke Hodge, you know, for 15 or whatever yard gain, and he separates his shoulder on that play. And you could just kind of feel the whole team just kind of get deflated.
Yep. Air went out of the sidelines.
Yeah.
Are you glad to see that series go away?
I mean, being played in Arlington, yes, I'm glad to see it going away. What's going to be great is, you know, the Arkansas fans who have never made that trip into College Station and Kyle Field, that's an experience. It is an experience to go to a game there.
I've always liked the experience in Arlington. I have found it to be very enjoyable. I understand why the teams want it gone. It's more advantageous to have home game. It does some things with recruiting. Obviously, it does some things with your schedule where you might get fewer home games one year than you do all the other teams that you're competing against. But I've always liked the game. It's going to be bittersweet to see that go away.
It's good for us because you can go into Dallas, you know, Dallas area, you know, the night before the game or whatever, and get good food and entertainment, that kind of thing. The fans, I think, will miss that because you're not going to find that in College Station. Unless you like Dancing with Cows.
Arkansas baseball, they're going to continue going down to Arlington in the future. So I guess you can get your Arlington fix there. Yeah. They've really found a foothold there with that early season event at the Rangers Stadium. All right, Chip, we appreciate you being with us. When we come back, Kelly Rolliard will be with us to talk Arkansas's number one ranked soccer team. A little bit later in the show, Carlos Collazo of Baseball America to discuss the Razorbacks on BA's top 100 draft prospect list. But first, a word from our sponsors.
LPGA Week in Northwest Arkansas returns September 23rd through the 29th for the 18th consecutive year. Watch former Razorbacks and 2024 Olympians Maria Fassi and Gabby Lopez compete against the world's best female golfers at the Walmart Northwest Arkansas Championship, presented by P&G at Pinnacle Country Club in Rogers. The NWA Championship is so much more than a golf tournament, with something for everyone to enjoy and activities for fans of all ages. Daily tickets are only $10, and kids 17 and under get in free with a ticketed adult. Get your tickets today at nwachampionship.com. At Kendall King, we're proud of over four decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Hey, welcome back. We appreciate you being with us. We want to tell you about our friends over at Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute in Rogers. They're your source for holistic wellness and your healthy lifestyle changes. They're located in Uptown Rogers, and the staff at Enhanced Healthcare will target your specific health plan for wellness, from neuropathy treatment, primary care, weight loss, and so much more. You can count on the experts at Enhanced Healthcare Wellness Institute in Rogers. We're joined on the desk now by Kelly Rolliard. She is the soccer analyst for SEC Network Games here in Fayetteville. Arkansas soccer ranked number one this week in the top drawer soccer rankings. As we record this, we have not gotten the coaches poll yet, but the expectation is that Arkansas probably will be at least as high as number two, maybe number one in that poll this week. First time in program history, though, Kelly, that they've ever had a number one ranking. You played for Arkansas, came here for the 2011 season, you were goalkeeper in 2012. When you see that the program that you committed to is ranked number one in the country, I just wonder how surreal that feels.
It feels very surreal. I can take no credit whatsoever. However, it's not surprising. Coach Hale has done an incredible job building this culture and this winning culture that we didn't have, quite frankly, when I played here. I was the first team under Coach Hale, and he came in and was just setting the standard from day one. And winning was, you know, the only thing and the only expectation that he had. And it's just been so cool to see the progress that he's had, the level of talent that he's able to recruit because of that. And so, yes, it is very cool to see them at number one, although just not surprising.
Take us behind the scenes of what the program looked like in the fall of 2011 when he got here versus what it looks like now.
Oh, gosh. drastically different. I mean, everything from, you know, core values to like playing together as a team are things that Colby really worked hard on just setting the foundation. And those are basic things that we truly just didn't have at the time when I was here in 2011 and 2012 is, you know, coming together as a team. I truly feel like we played as individuals and that's why we weren't winning. So Coach Hale, his first thing was, again, setting those core values. A lot of them were due to or instilled of like beat for we. So like you're playing for the person next to you. And that still very much is a core value that this team 2024 has. They have a paddle on the sidelines. Mm-hmm. They all sign and have their names on them. Mm-hmm. And that's a reminder of, hey, you are playing for this team rather than yourself. You are committed to doing whatever it takes to get a win for this program. Whether you're playing 10 minutes, 24 minutes, 90 minutes, or 0 minutes, you have a mission and you have to do that in order for this team to succeed.
You were there the other day. They beat Missouri 8-2. They're winning 6-0 at halftime. And then, you know, obviously it's 2-2 after the half. Anthony Christensen, who covers the team, he said, I've never seen a coach so upset after a 6-goal victory. But to me, that is what makes Colby and this program so good, is that they're not satisfied just with winning. They are measuring themselves not against the other team. I feel like they're measuring themselves against perfection. And when that's your mirror, it can lead to some really good things.
That's very well said. And that is just who Colby Hill is. Mm-hmm. And that's the standard. He really doesn't care about the score until that final buzzer sounds. And yes, he was disappointed in that second half play, because to be honest, Arkansas did get outworked in that second half. And that's when Missouri came and scored 2 goals against Arkansas. But yes, he is the only coach who would be, sad or disappointed, rather, with their performance in that second 45 minutes. But again, back to what you were saying about Colby, he is, the only coach in the history who would do that. But again, it says a lot about the program, who they are, and why they are winning.
How good do you think this team is?
The sky's the limit. Truly, this team is the best that I have seen in the program. Just the level of talent that they have. But I think at the beginning of the year, Coach Hale didn't really know what to expect. I mean, they have 11 new faces this year. Mm-hmm. I think it's 5 or 6 freshmen and then a few transfers. And those transfers are so hard. It's so hard to come into a new program and adapt to the team and the culture. But again, he has this style of play that is so unique. And so it almost makes that environment much, I'd not say easier, but much more like, hey, you have to buy in order to win. And they've been able to do that. So yes, they have proven themselves every single game. They've gotten better every single game. And that confidence and endurance and everything, they're moving that momentum and moving the needle every single game.
So you mentioned the style. And I can see it, what's different. But for people who haven't watched this team, and I'll make an analogy here. You can tell me if I'm wrong or not. I think about Nolan Richardson's 40 minutes of hell and how just unique that was, and that they put constant pressure on the opposition. It kind of feels like this is soccer's equivalent to that, and it's something that's very unique, at least in the college game.
It is very unique. Every week when we interview the opposing coach before the games, we say, what's your strategy going mm-hmm. in? And almost every single one of them say, to be honest, it's hard. We don't know. Because most teams, when you go up against them, you're able to say, okay, I can focus on, 3 or 4 people. If we can shut them down, mm-hmm. we can eliminate a lot of chances on goal. But you can't do that against a team like Arkansas. They have 17 goal scorers who have scored at least 1 goal this season. Mm-hmm. That is just unheard of in soccer in history. But your strategy coming in, you have to be so different in your approach with Arkansas. They're high pressure. It's so intense, and they outwork every team that they play. And I think that's something Coach Hill is very proud of. And even back to when I played, fitness was a big deal, but it's a certain type of level that he expects you to come in and mm-hmm. play at and perform. But yes, back to their unique style. He always says too, he doesn't care what happens in between the 18-yard boxes. It's what happens in those 18-yard boxes that win and lose games. Mm-hmm. And that's been so true and so real to the Arkansas style.
You made a good point on the broadcast the other day. You were talking about their set pieces and how hard those are to defend. And that really, you might get a goal or two off of those, and that can be the difference in a game. Just kind of explain to us about the set pieces and what they do so well, because that's something I've heard from coaches too, that's very difficult to prepare for.
It is. Their quality of service on set pieces, I think, also makes it first just extremely difficult to defend because they do have what you call plays for set pieces, which most teams, just a strategy of just trying to get the ball in the back of the net. That's usually what teams do, but Arkansas is so different. I mean, I remember back in my day, we had one that was just like pancake and everyone ran pancake and it was certain players coming to get the ball and in certain areas and marking up certain areas. So it was just chaotic. Mm-hmm. And that's the chaos that they instill in the other team on those set pieces, that it's just like, you're so worried about what the heck Arkansas is doing and not even so much on the ball. And then by the time you realize what they're doing, the ball's in the back of the net.
So it's kind of like eye candy.
Right.
Right. I mean, it's kind of like motion in football. You're moving people around and confusing. That's a great analogy. You know, you mentioned that they're as good as they've ever been. And they had such a really strong core there for a few years with players like Anna Potizil, Parker Goins, Haley Van Fossen, Taylor Malum. They lose them, and yet they seem like they're better. I wonder, does that just speak to the program? I mean, why do you think that happened?
I think it speaks to the program, but it also speaks to the Ava Tankersleys, the people under them, because they know the shoes they have to fill of those people who have left and gone on to play pro or gone on to other things. They set the expectation that, okay, they left us this legacy, and we know that that is, you know, something we are going to try to even just cross, and the expectations just continue to go up. And so I think that's just really cool that those leaders have really taken on the responsibility of making this program even better than those legacy players you mentioned did and left behind for them.
So they play Vanderbilt and South Carolina this week. Those are typically a couple of pretty good programs. I've got their records here. Vanderbilt's 5-1-3 this season. South Carolina, one of the better teams in the league. They're unbeaten, but they have tied four times. South Carolina will be here at home. That always feels like that's kind of a measuring stick for Arkansas is, can they beat South Carolina? If they can get over the South Carolina hump, which they've done a few times in the last few years, things seem to go pretty well for them, though. I just wonder, I know you're not calling either game, but have you looked, do you know much about those programs and what those games will be like this week?
Well, in just general, in the SEC, every team is good. Mm-hmm. And Coach Hale, even when I played, but still to this day, he says, we don't have like a quote massive game. Like people say like, oh, Vanderbilt's a massive game or South Carolina's, you know, a big one. We really got to be on our A game. That's not his strategy. The most important game is the next one. Mm. And that's also something that I think is their winning culture and their mentality of why they're able to go in and win these quote big games. But every team in the SEC is so good. I mean, you look across the board, the talent on every single one of these rosters is so extensive. So going back to Vanderbilt and South Carolina, yeah, they're both amazing teams. South Carolina also has a player that matches up really, really well from a goal scoring perspective, like Kate Doyle. They're actually leading the SEC together. So it is going to be, or they both are going to be very tough matches. Arkansas is going to have to come out and be Arkansas. It will be a test because they're back on the road. Like you said, they have such an advantage of, you know, winning at home, but back to their last game on the road with Michigan, they tied 2-2, a very, very, very good team. But now we're in conference play where it just means more. So I do expect them to come out and just play their game and just be hungry for those wins.
They lost to Pitt in the tournament last year, but regular season-wise, I don't think a team has beaten them here in Fayetteville since South Carolina in 2020. Am I right?
That is right. They remain unbeaten in 38 of the last 39 matches going back to 2021, which is just very, very crazy when you think about it, but also just really cool because it shows how much pride they have in, you know, their fans and the environment that they play in at home, that they care about not only winning for the program and their team, but like the fans that truly come out to support them.
I want to ask you about a couple of newcomers real quick. Kate Doyle, you mentioned her transfer from Gonzaga, highest scoring player on the highest scoring team in the country. And then you've been real impressed, you told me, with Keegan Smith, the freshman goalkeeper. You played in goal. Just kind of explain to me what you've seen from her, and then Doyle, what has she added to this team?
Yeah, so I'll first talk about Kate Doyle. I mean, what a stud, first of all, to come into this program Coach Hale actually said when I asked last about her, he said she could go play in any program in the country and make as big of an impact as she's had here. But obviously they're very fortunate to have a player like her. But she's just one of those people that, you know, has a big personality on and off the field, has been a true leader. And so it's been so, so cool to watch her. She has 8 goals this season. And then Keegan Smith, I mean, wow. She's a freshman keeper who has come in and had shutouts, who has stood in the back of that goal and had the presence of, I'd say, a junior keeper. And that is not easy to do in this program or just in college soccer or in the SEC. Mm-hmm. I have been so impressed with her, and I think it's just going to continue to get better because her experience, her knowledge in the game, and learning how to just work with her team to organize and be a good defender and be a whole part of that team will just get better. So I think the ceiling for her is extremely high.
Last one for you. A lot of people, when they look at Arkansas soccer, and I hate that they do this, they look at what's happened in the SEC tournament and that they've lost in the championship, what, 6 times in 7 years, something
like
that.
It's a curse.
But two things. Number one, I feel like the style that Arkansas plays is actually not advantageous for the SEC tournament, where you've got to play, what, 3 times in 6 days?
Yeah.
But I also look at, to me, what is important to me is not if you're the best team 1 week. It's if you're the best team all year. It's just like SEC baseball. I don't care what happens in Hoover, because I'm more interested in what happens in the 30 games that lead up to Hoover. Same thing with soccer. Arkansas has won 4 of the last 5 regular season SEC championships. They might win again this year, 5 out of 6. And then they have success in the NCAA tournament more often than not. Last year was a little bit of an anomaly. They usually have made it to the second weekend here the last several years. Your thoughts on SEC soccer tournament and maybe how much that championship overshadows what I think is the legitimate one, the regular season?
No, I'd actually agree with you. And I don't know if it is like a mental thing now because they are, you know, getting to the championship and unfortunately just not winning and pulling out that last win. But it is so tough. I mean, I think back to our days and you have to play so many games and your bodies are by that point are just so worn down. Recovery is a huge part of it, but you're just exhausted. And I'm not making excuses. Coach Hale would, you know, be hitting me up on the head right now saying, don't make excuses for us, because that's not what we do. But yeah, it's a tough tournament. And at the end of the day, your games before that, your RPI, you're winning against teams that matter early in the season. That's what's going to get you into that NCAA tournament. Obviously, Coach Hale wants a win of the NCAA or in the SEC tournament. So that's still a goal, but it's at the end of the day, getting into that NCAA tournament, into that Final Four, is all that matters.
Kelly, thank you for coming down.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me.
Great talking to you about Arkansas soccer. They'll play Vanderbilt on Thursday. They'll be back home Sunday at 1 o'clock against South Carolina over at Razorback Field. When we come back, Carlos Collazo from Baseball America will join us. Their new top 100 draft rankings are out, and there are 3 Razorbacks on this list. We'll talk to him about that and more, but first, another word from our sponsors.
Taste, sip, sample, and discover the very best restaurants and chefs Northwest Arkansas has to offer at the Bite Experience at the LPGA, a unique culinary experience on site at the Northwest Arkansas Championship. Tickets are available Friday, September 27th through Sunday, September 29th, offering access to the best golf viewing and food and beverage samples from over 30 local restaurants. You don't want to miss this. Tickets are available for $45 a day. Get yours before they sell out at BiteNWA.com. At Kendall King, we're proud of over 4 decades of design. We're continuing the legacy of great creative design by combining our brands of Kendall King, Soapbox, and ShopCart. Together, these brands represent a new focus in marketing design, with individual attention to specific areas. Through our design expertise supported by a team of talented professionals, we showcase our best. We are Kendall King, we are Soapbox, we are ShopCart, we are design.
Hey, welcome back. We appreciate you being with us. We want to tell you about our friends over at Bentonville Glass. They've been serving their community since 1971. They're committed, professional, and versatile. If you're looking for a quality leader in Northwest Arkansas or looking for skilled craftsmanship, look no further than Bentonville Glass for all your glass market needs with the highest quality products. You can come by and see them today at 507 South Main in Bentonville or online at bentonvilleglass.com. We're joined now by Carlos Collazo. He works for Baseball America, does a lot of prospect rankings, draft rankings for that publication. And I've said this many times, Baseball America, one of my favorite subscriptions that I have. You guys do a great job there, Carlos, and we appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, well, thank you for the kind words, and thanks for having me.
So the reason I wanted to have you on is because you guys have just recently put out your top 100 draft prospects list for the 2025 class. You've got three Razorbacks on there, Vahevo Aloy, Zach Root, Landon Beidelschies. And I'll tell you, Vahevo being number 20 really surprised me. I know he's got a big bat, and I know that, you know, it feels like there's a lot of raw talent there that maybe has been untapped to this point. Why do you like him so much? Because, I mean, you're talking about a potential first-round pick there.
Yeah, I think at this point he probably is one of the more exciting college middle infielders in the class. That's always a pretty premium profile in general. And when you have a guy like Vahevo who has this sort of tool set that he has, I know it really excites a lot of scouts who want to dream on the upside potential. If you look at a guy like Vahevo and maybe can see some improvements in his approach and the strikeout rate in his draft year, I think he's got pretty exciting upside. There are some warts that you could pick apart in the profile. I think he is a little bit aggressive as a hitter at times, maybe some more miss on sliders in particular than you would like to see. But I think when everything is clicking, when he gets extended, when he's on time, when he's recognizing pitches, he does a lot really well. I think the quality of contact he's able to generate is really impressive. His top end power numbers are pretty impressive, particularly for a player who might project to stick at shortstop in the long run. So really, when you're looking at Vahevo, you're looking at a premium defensive profile with a lot more offensive upside, I think, than we've seen, specifically maybe at Arkansas. I know his freshman year at Sacramento State was maybe a little more impressive in terms of just overall production. I'm really curious to see what kind of adjustments he makes in his second year in the SEC.
Well, you know, he made some swing adjustments this summer up at the Cape Cod League. I wonder, did you see a whole lot of what he did in that league, and did that influence you at all? Because he had some really impressive numbers there with the new batting stance.
Yeah, I didn't see him in person. I've watched a lot of video of it, and it does remind me of a guy like Cam Smith from a year ago with Florida State, who had probably a worse overall approach than Vahevo has shown in his college career. He went to the Cape and made a lot of adjustments, both mechanically and just in terms of like the pitches he's swinging at. And that translated to this spring season in his draft year. He got picked in the first round, and then he went off and was maybe one of the most impressive 24 debut draftees in pro ball this summer. So it's a lot to live up to kind of that that timeline. But I think those are some of the adjustments that scouts are hoping to see from him. The Cape is obviously a very highly regarded environment for baseball players. And to be able to show some improvements and to show kind of the signs of some offensive adjustments, I think is really encouraging. I'll be curious to see if it sticks. I think one of my criticisms of the Cape in recent years is like a lot of the top arms really are not pitching in the summer in general. Mm-hmm. It's tough to get those arms to the Cape to pitch for a full summer. So I do think it will be more meaningful if he's able to kind of sustain those improvements against the caliber of the pitching he's going to see consistently in the SEC.
So much of Vahevo, the talk about him is offense and what he can do with his big bat. Defensively, what do you see from him?
Yeah, I think he's got a chance to be at least a solid defender at shortstop now. I am more excited to see a little bit more of him. I'm only just now starting to focus on a lot of these 2025. So a lot of what I know about him is kind of based on reporting from scouts. So that'll be an area that I'm really bearing down on more. I think he has all the physical tools necessary to stick at the position, but that's definitely an area that I'm like looking to maybe pick apart a little bit more. I don't see any reason why he couldn't play the position right now, I'd say. I guess I'm curious, what do you think about him now? You've probably seen him a lot more in person, live watching him.
I can tell you what the coaches will tell you is that he is a better defender than maybe what the stats say. That was one of the things when he came to Arkansas, Dave Van Horn shared this with me. Basically, Dave said, are you going to let me coach you? Because, you know, and Vahevo was very eager to be coached defensively. And so, you know, his defensive numbers last year were pretty good. I think they can be better. I do think that his size gives him a lot better range than some of the shortstops. He's real tall, maybe not real tall for a shortstop, but he's one of the taller shortstops that you'll see, and I think that helps him defensively. And he's got a huge arm.
Yeah, it is interesting how many like big shortstops are playing the position now. I know the sport is just getting larger and larger, and it's like at the point now where I see like a 6'4" shortstop at the position, and I don't immediately write them off and push them to third, because you just see so many high-end athletes that are able to make it work and with defensive positioning that can help shore up some things. But yeah, I guess my impression of him as a defender right now is like nothing exceptional, and it's also nothing where I'm like really concerned about his defensive profile moving forward now, but certainly looking forward to like flesh out that opinion on him.
Yeah, the fielding percentage wasn't great at Sacramento State, but you know, there are a lot of things that might go into that. You've got two left-handed pitchers here, a couple of transfers for Arkansas. Zach Root from East Carolina, Landon Bidlesey's transferred in from Ohio State. If you haven't been out to the ballpark this fall, you haven't seen them pitch in a Razorback uniform yet. What have you seen from those two, and what helped them crack this list?
Yeah, I think really they're just two of the better transfer left-handed pitchers in the class. I think we had them ranked on Peter Flaherty. He does a top 100 transfer portal rankings for us, both ranked top 13, I believe, in that list. And I think with Root, you've got a pitcher who's a very crafty, kind of deceptive left-hander that has a little bit of funk that he's throwing at you. Both of his secondaries, a breaking ball and a changeup, were particularly effective last spring for East Carolina. He's got a fastball that sits in the low 90s, but he's been up to 96, 97. And then you've got a guy like Landon Bidlesey, who maybe throws a little bit harder at peak velocity. He's been up to 98 in the past. Another guy who's had effective secondaries. I think for Bidlesey specifically, we're looking for him to show a little bit more of a third pitch. He's had some experience in the past as a reliever. Last spring, he took on more of a starter load, and that was effective and impressive. But as he moves into the SEC and as he just continues to develop as a starter, that third pitch is going to be key. I think for Zach Root, we've seen a little bit more of the changeup more consistently, and we know that that pitch is pretty solid now. But I think even when you've got Arkansas replacing the entirety of a starting rotation that was really one of the most dominant in the country for the entire year last spring, it's a pretty good foundation with these two left-handers coming in. I know they have some younger pitchers as well on staff and some recruits coming in from this 2024 high school class that could make an impact as well. But a pretty good starting point, I would say, getting these two names in the portal. This top 100 list for us is really like top three round types. So at this point, we're projecting them to have more top three round draft picks than they had in this past year's team, which is pretty impressive. But we'll see how they all pan out. But in terms of raw talent stuff, pretty well-rounded left-handed pitching profiles at this point, I'd say.
So Hagan Smith was the number five pick in the draft earlier this year. The Chicago White Sox took him, highest drafted pitcher Arkansas has ever had, which is kind of surprising. But the expectation, it feels like, within the White Sox community is that he can maybe move through their system pretty quickly. And if you look at, I think about this, Carlos, look at what Paul Skeens and Wyatt Langford and Dylan Cruz did the year before draft-wise. We've seen other players like Ben Joyce, Garrett Crochet, even Andrew Benintendi, if you go back a little bit further, Alex Bregman. Seems like a lot of these SEC players, once they get into the minors, the real high-end ones at least, they've got a tendency to move through there pretty quick and get up to the majors. How fast do you think Hagan can get through the White Sox system?
I think he can move extremely quickly. I mean, the White Sox are an organization that has not been hesitant to move players fast. Garrett Crochet, who was a left-handed pitcher they drafted a few years ago, who moved extremely quickly in a reliever role. Then they transitioned him into a starting role, and that was pretty successful overall for him. I kind of view Hagan in a similar tier. If they wanted to push him as a reliever, I think he has the pure stuff right now to get outs in a big league bullpen. I don't know if that necessarily is the best developmental route for him. And I think if they're going to push him as a starter, which they should, that's where his upside is. That's where I expect him to pitch in the long term. The starting path might take a little bit longer. But like you mentioned, with all these players who have moved really quickly in recent years, the development of minor league players in general has really gotten a lot quicker in the last few years, just given how the minor league system is set up. I think there is an understanding, or at least an expectation, that the colleges are doing a better job developing players at this point, and teams really have just been drafting players and pushing them aggressively and letting them tell the organization when it's too fast, because you can push a player and be aggressive with them. And I think in terms of pure stuff, Hagan would stand out to me in the last several years in terms of like the quality of his stuff from the left side, especially. There aren't too many pitchers that really stack up with the fastball slider combination that he has. And the improvements that he showed as a pure pitcher and starter last spring and really flashed in his pro debut, I think he should be challenged. He should be pitched quickly. The White Sox are pretty desperate to get some of this young talent up and to get out of the major league doldrums that they've been in. It's a pretty bad year. Everyone in the front office and upper management is going to be incentivized to push players quickly and kind of get out of that. I don't really see what would be holding Hagen back. Like, you don't need to baby him. He's a guy who's pitched a lot of innings. He's been a high profile prospect going back to his high school years. He's pitched at the best level in college. I really do expect him to move pretty quickly.
And the White Sox, they've been pretty good at drafting pitchers the last couple of years, or at least that's been a high area of emphasis for them, right?
Yeah, and it seems like low-slot left-handers in particular have been a focus. Noah Schultz, who is their number one pitching prospect at the moment, he was a high school draftee, and they helped him add a lot of power to his game, mm-hmm. helped him improve his breaking ball and the consistency of that pitch. And then even in this past draft class with Hagen Smith and a couple of the other left-handed pitchers the White Sox took, it seems like either slot or release point for left-handed pitchers is either a focus for them, or it's just been a coincidence that they've taken a lot of these sorts of profiles. But between Hagen, Noah Schultz, Colson Montgomery, I think the top end of the White Sox list is pretty excited now. There's going to be a lot of expectations for those players to kind of help them on this next wave and to help them become a more competitive team at the big league level. But yeah, the White Sox, I think, definitely have targeted a lot of left-handers. We've got three left-handed pitchers in their top 10 right now. And like I said, a number of intriguing kind of low slot lefties in particular.
You know, here in Fayetteville, we're in Cardinals country, to a lesser extent, Royals country. And as we went to the draft, Hagen, you know, depending on what you read, number six by some publications, number seven by others. Well, the Royals drafted sixth, the Cardinals drafted seventh. There was a lot of thought that he might end up with one of these, you know, major league franchises that are real popular in our state. And I said, I wouldn't be surprised by the White Sox, because they have taken a lot of Arkansas players over the year, like Peyton Paulette is a pitcher who they took high a couple of years ago and maybe took a little bit of a risk on drafting him because he was coming off of the elbow injury. Do you see that in drafts where organizations, maybe they like players from certain college teams? Like we see it in the NFL, Bill Belichick seemed to like to draft Nick Saban players from Alabama. I think you kind of – I mean, do you see that in Major League Baseball, any correlation between a college program and an organizational front office?
I would say less so programs, and you do have more of a tendency for orgs to select specific traits or even specific geographic regions. I know for me in particular, the Reds are a team that stands out as a team that has really drafted players out of Florida at a high level, and specifically the University of Florida. So there is some of that. Mm-hmm. I think the White Sox to Arkansas connection is a good call. It's not something that I specifically honed in on before the draft. I'll have to look back at that more and see just how active they have been. But I would say for me in particular, like we hear a lot more about the sorts of traits that teams really covet, whether a team really wants to draft pitchers that have riding fastballs, or whether a team really prioritizes hitters who control the zone and make a lot of contact. Those are the sort of traits that I feel like we hear tied to more teams. Now, there are some other organizations, like I think the Mariners are one that stands out as a team who has really drafted heavily in the Carolinas in particular. For me, I just think that is generally they're a college heavy drafting team, and there are a lot of colleges to pick from in the Carolinas. But I would say it's more traits based and less college program based. Although again, I say that, and a few years ago, Miami had a pretty strong Vanderbilt to Marlins connection, just given some of the coaching and scouting ties between those two orgs. So it definitely happens. And speaking of like Hagen Smith, where we had him ranked, I'll just say that the entire spring, it was super tough for me to kind of decide who we were having one. It was pretty split in the scouting community. I know as a BA staff, a lot of us preferred the left-handed side of that equation. And I think we probably bounced them back and forth every update. It was so tough to line those guys up.
It was just a tough draft. It was all about who liked, who was looking for what. I mean, JJ Weatherholt was the number one prospect at some point in time, and he ends up going seventh to the Cardinals. Your point about regions is well taken. It could be that, you know, an organization maybe trust the evaluation of one area scout over another. Yep. Who knows? Maybe it's just coincidence, but Arkansas's had a lot of former players in the White Sox organization, including at the big league team, whether it be Keuchel after he, you know, goes through free agency, James McCann, Benintendi's on that team this year, Dominic Fletcher's on that team this year. They've drafted some others. It's just kind of interesting how there's an Arkansas White Sox tie. I want to ask you real quick, what's changed about the draft since 2020, where, you know, now it's a shorter draft? It just seems to me like, especially early on, maybe the top 30, 40 picks, we're seeing way more college players than we used to see. Is it a byproduct of college baseball being older? Is it a byproduct of college baseball being better? What do you see?
I think it's a combination of both those things that you mentioned. I think it's also a trend that's been going on even before the 2020 draft, really throughout the bonus pool era, which is 2012 to the current era. We have seen just more and more college players drafted. I think even since like the start of the century, that's been a trend that's happening just over time. For whatever reason, whether it's the analytics, I think there is a lot more comfort from the decision makers up top in just having a bigger body of statistics that you can look at. There's TrackMan data and underlying batted ball data for hitters at a level that you don't have quite as much at the high school level. I think just the fact that a lot of these college players, the perception of more safety in their profile and the fact that they're going to move quicker. Mm-hmm. If you're not confident that you're going to have a job as the general manager of a team 6 years down the line, maybe it makes it a lot less exciting to take a high school pitcher who's going to need that full 6 years. I think additionally, and although with all those things that I just mentioned, those have been going on for years and years and years. The current system that we have with fewer minor league teams, fewer lower level minor league teams, fewer spots on rosters, it makes it a lot harder to take these projection players. And typically when I'm talking about these players, it's high school players who are incredibly raw, high school players who need a lot of physical development. The leash for those players in pro ball is a lot shorter today than it was 5 years ago, 6 years ago. So you have to be really committed to developing those players and having a spot for those players. And I think it's a lot harder to fail in pro baseball now and kind of maintain your spot. And you don't have to worry about that for several years. There's much more because everything is quicker now. I think those roster spots are more, there's a lot more turnover. I think this past year, we were talking about this the other day on a podcast, only 18% of the draft was the high school demographic. Mm. If you look back at the 70s, 80s and 90s, like the high schoolers were kind of the cream of the crop in terms of the draft. Everyone wanted toolsy high school players, but I think college baseball has gotten a lot better since then. So it's kind of a lot of moving parts, but a direction that the industry has been going for some time now.
Before I get you out of here, Heston Kerstad, what's his situation with the Orioles? Why is he up and down so much? What do you see his future being?
I think for the short term, they really just have had kind of a lot of outfielders that he needs to kind of mix and match with. I think he's been pretty good in terms of a minor league prospect. I was excited about him entering this year. I think the power OBP combination that he provides is going to be an appealing one. I think he's got all the tools to be a regular moving forward. Really, for me, it's like, what is that outfield going to look like around him? Because he's limited to a corner, he maybe doesn't have some of the defensive versatility that a Colton Cowser can offer, but I would expect him to be a pretty solid regular moving forward. And if it's with Baltimore, I would imagine he's going to be a key piece of a competitive team for the next few years. That's definitely a pick that in hindsight, I wish we had him a little bit higher up our board. I think we had him consistently in kind of that 13 to 16 range on our rankings. And when he was selected second at the time, I remember being really surprised that Austin Martin wasn't in that spot. And he's looked like a very, very astute pick, like many of these Orioles selections at the top of the draft in recent years.
I was on a bike ride. I thought for sure Heston Kerstad wasn't going to get picked until say like the 7 o'clock hour. And I'm pulling into my driveway and somebody's like, Kerstad just went number two. It's like, holy cow.
You were surprised. I was also surprised as well. I don't think we heard much buzz about him specifically going that high at the time. I think we probably had him mocked again outside of the top 10. So mm-hmm. on the Orioles.
Well, Carlos, we appreciate your time. You're going to be busy with Razorbacks this year, talking to the people in the building over there. They've got a lot of draft eligible players. They think this could be their highest number of draft picks in one class this year. So, and they've, I think that's saying something because they're typically up there with the Tennessees and the LSUs of the world in terms of having a number of draft picks. We appreciate you being with us.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me.
Carlos Collazo of Baseball America. Be sure to check out his coverage throughout the off season and obviously leading up to the 2025 draft. We appreciate you being with us today. Tomorrow on our podcast, we'll have Olin Buchanan from TexAgs to help us break down the Arkansas-Texas A&M matchup. On Thursday, Arkansas Athletics Director Hunter Yurachek will be with us. Until then, hope you'll join us at our website, wholehogsports.com. Have a great day, everyone.